If you go to our website, www.mentalhealthday.org, you'll discover that today's date is National Take a Mental Health Day. If you go there tomorrow, you'll discover that tomorrow's date is National Take a Mental Health Day, and the day after that, too. So that proves that today is National Take a Mental Health Day, and so is tomorrow.
Your podcast starts in 3, 2, 1.
Oh. Good morning, Doctor. Time to wake up.
Oh. Well, thank you, Ivan. It's going to be a great day at the Mental Health Day podcast. I'm Todd Finnerty. I'm a clinical psychologist. And welcome to the Mental Health Day podcast number 4, coming to you from the William James... Coming to you from the armchair in my office. And today we have a jam-packed interview for this Mental Health Day podcast number 4. Russell Barkley. An interview with Russell Barkley on managing ADHD. Now, if you wanted to hear anyone talk about ADHD, it would be Russell Barkley. Russell Barkley has written countless books and countless research publications. He's spoken all over the world. He's internationally known, and he is the person to talk to about ADHD, especially if you want a scientific perspective on things. And I am not going to delay. I'm just going to get you right into the interview, because he was so kind and so gracious. He's a very nice man, and here we go. We talked quite a while, and it's definitely worth a listen.
Yeah, hi, Todd. It's Russ Barkley.
Hey, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you as well. Is this a good time?
Yeah, this is a great time. This is a great time.
Terrific.
Well, this is for the podcast at mentalhealthday.org.
Yeah.
And so the listeners just got to hear an introduction of you. Presumably, I haven't actually recorded it yet.
Okay.
But
okay.
We'll save time on that regard, because I don't want to waste
great.
Too much of your time.
Thank you.
No problem. You've described ADHD as a disorder of executive functioning. Can you tell us, what does that mean, and what implications does that have for managing ADHD?
Well, executive functioning, as you know, is a term that's widely used both in the scientific journals as well now in trade books and professional books as well. And yet it's a very poorly defined term if one actually goes in to look at how people are using it. So to me and to most neuropsychologists, the term means, to some extent, self-regulation, how well an individual is able to manage, organize, and sustain their behavior over time in order to accomplish the goals that they've set for themselves, or goals that they have to accomplish because they've been assigned by other people, like when teachers give academic assignments, for instance. So the core of executive functioning is self-regulation. And in my books and in my theory of executive functioning, it's composed of different abilities, different things that we do to manage ourselves. And I can go into each of those if you would like very quickly.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. Well, what defines an executive function is something you're doing to yourself to change your behavior from what it would have been had you just automatically and impulsively responded. So something you do to yourself to change yourself in order to change your future. Not so much to change the moment, though it might. It's really a future-directed activity. So it's behavior over time. And that becomes very important, because this is the part of the brain that directs behavior away from the now and toward the future. And it's something very unique to humans that other species really don't share, this ability to be future-oriented, to have a purpose, and to aim your behavior toward that purpose. So we have a suite of mental abilities in the front part of our brain, largely, that allow us to regulate our behavior over time. And each of them is a thing that we do to ourselves. And in my theory, there are several things that people do to manage themselves in order to change their future for the better. The first thing they do is they develop the ability to stop, to inhibit their automatic behavior. Because if you don't do that, then there's no point in regulating your behavior. You've already acted. You've done something on impulse. So you have to be able to inhibit these automatic impulses. The second thing is you must be aware of yourself and what you're doing. It's self-monitoring or self-awareness, because this goes hand in hand with the impulse control, with the stopping ability. There's no point in stopping if you're not aware of what you're doing, and no point in being aware of what you're doing if you can't interrupt it and change the course of what you're doing. So these two probably develop simultaneously, the ability to monitor ourselves and be aware of what we are and what we want to do, and also the ability to inhibit ourselves from engaging in very impulsive action. Now, those I see are the two founding executive abilities that we're doing. Now, you couple those with several others that become very important. The third is the ability to see to yourself. This is visual imagery. People can hold an image in mind, and the image they're holding in mind in this case is their goal, what they hope to achieve. So we use visual images like a GPS in our cars to guide us over time to get to that goal. So these images become very important, and humans have the greatest capacity for imagination of any other species. The fourth ability is that we talk to ourselves, the mind's voice. We direct our language back at ourselves, and we do this out loud, and then as we get older, we actually write ourselves notes like do lists and things that we put into calendars and cues that we put in various places to remind us of what we need to be doing there. So we use language to ourselves as a form of self-control. And then all four of these lead to the next one, which is the ability to control your emotions. So that we have the ability to actually create new emotions that didn't exist by using images and words in our mind to provoke that emotion. So if I want to grieve, for instance, I might call up an image of a real-life grief reaction that I had in my past, an event that happened, say the death of a parent, and that would bring about the feelings of sadness that I'm trying to create. We also use this to counteract negative emotions that we're having. So if we get upset or we're angry or we're frustrated, we might count to 10, talk to ourselves, and go to our happy place, which is imagine that we're somewhere else that's very relaxing. So this ability to use images and words to change our emotions is very important, and it also helps us with our motivation, because motivation is part of the larger domain of emotions. So if you can control your emotions, you can control your self-motivation as well. And then finally, not to go on too long here, the last one is the ability to problem solve, to create various options, to kind of simulate possibilities. When we're faced with a problem or an obstacle, or we're not quite sure how we want to accomplish what it is we want to do, then we start to generate possibilities in our mind. We manipulate things in our mind. And this problem-solving ability is very important, and I think it's based on play, the ability of children to take apart and recombine their environment to discover what happens when they do. And I'm not the first person to argue this point, that children's play is very much linked to adult problem-solving, which I think the evidence would show that it clearly is. So those are your executive abilities, because each of them is something you're doing to yourself, to change your future, to make it better. And they interact like a symphony, and we use all of them, some more than others, depending on the problem or the situation or the goal. But we have this, I call it a Swiss Army knife of mind tools that we're continuously using all the time. Now, where does ADHD fit in? It interferes with all of them. And that's because ADHD is largely a disorder of inhibition. And since, as I said, inhibition is the foundation of this executive system, like the foundation of a house, if the foundation is poor, not working well, then the house collapses or gets into trouble. And that's where ADHD comes from. And it interferes with all of these abilities. So it's not just an attention disorder. It's a disorder of self-control.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, the one piece of that is regulating your emotions. And I think a lot of times people don't think about emotions and ADHD together. You know, we have bipolar NOS and disruptive mood dysregulation disorder and things like that. But, you know, when you think about ADHD, you don't always think about moody kids all the time necessarily. I mean, we do to some respect, but we don't think about emotions as much all the time. We think about it in attentiveness. We think about hyperactivity and behavior problems, but we don't always think about controlling emotions, I think.
Yeah, that's quite right. And that view is now changing. But as you know, for the last 30 years, the various diagnostic manuals that we've used have defined ADHD precisely as you just did, that it's a problem with being inattentive and distractible. It's a problem with being impulsive and lacking inhibition. And it's a problem for most people with being very active and restless. And so people didn't really associate emotional problems or dysregulation with ADHD. But starting around 2 years ago, a number of papers and reviews began to address this issue, and all of them uniformly concluded that ADHD has embedded in it just as much of a problem with emotional control as it does with any other type of self-control, and that emotional difficulties are a central part of the disorder, which is kind of interesting because back in 1902, one of the first historic papers about ADHD actually said that, and it's almost like we sort of forgot this part of it, but it argued that the emotional discontrol was a central feature of the disorder, and beginning around 1970, we sort of began forgetting about that. But it's very important to keep that in mind. Now, it leads to a good question, and that is, how does ADHD differ from these other mood disorders that you mentioned? And if I might, very quickly, there's a couple of things that would help differentiate these problems. May I go on?
Yes, please, do.
Okay, the first thing is that the emotional problem in ADHD is not a mood disorder. It's a self-control disorder. The emotions that these people are having are normal, but they're the normal primary emotions, the automatic emotions that we would experience. Now, in most people, as we mature, we learn to quell and suppress those primary emotions because they can be very strong and they can be very upsetting to other people, upsetting to ourselves, and offensive. So you have to learn emotional restraint and emotional maturity, and that is the self-control part. And that's what ADHD people have trouble with. The emotion they experience is the same one you might experience, but you don't show it. You suppress it, you moderate it, and then you show one that is more controlled, mature, and most importantly, not going to offend other people and is going to be more consistent with your goals. What are you trying to accomplish here? Because your primary emotions can get in the way of your goals very quickly if you were to show them impulsively in their raw, unmoderated form. And yet that's what people with ADHD do. So let's be clear, their emotions are normal, but they're the primary emotions, and the person should have shown more executive control, more self-control. So ADHD causes a top-down problem in the self-regulation of normal emotions, whereas mood disorders are bottom-up disorders. The individual is displaying far more emotion than other people to excess, including the primary emotions, so that their mood states are not normal. They're emotions that other people wouldn't necessarily have in those situations, as you might see in, say, the mania of somebody with bipolar disorder or the severe, almost suicidal depression that you might see in someone with major depressive disorder or the panic attacks you might see in someone with an anxiety disorder. Those are abnormal emotions that other people wouldn't have in that situation. So that's a very good distinguishing feature for individuals with ADHD. Their emotions are normal but primary and poorly regulated, but not abnormal, grotesque, capricious, extreme, or irrational. And by irrational, I mean that they're not consistent with the situation and how other people would feel. So if you focus on those, it can help you separate ADHD from these other emotional disorders.
That makes sense. Well, knowing this about executive functioning, these different domains, is there things we can take from that to kind of help manage ADHD in different...
I think so. I think it helps to think of management, in my view. Management comes down to five things. First, of course, is an appropriate diagnosis and evaluation. So that goes without saying, but I always start with that because, as you know, the evaluation is the first step of treatment. And making sure that the evaluation is done appropriately and comprehensively is very important. But that said, the next step is educating the patient and their family about the nature of ADHD, especially this new view of ADHD as a self-control executive disorder, and making sure that families and patients understand that this is largely a neurobiological condition, much like autism, much like other disorders like mental retardation and Tourette's syndrome. This is not a condition that is the result of upbringing, parenting, television, diet, and so on. It's not to say that you can't make it worse with some of these environmental social factors, but they're not the primary cause of the condition, and we need to make sure families understand that. So educating them about the condition, just as you would somebody with diabetes. You wouldn't start out by giving them insulin. You would start out with a review of what is diabetes, and that helps the patient understand what's going wrong and then why they need the treatments you're going to recommend. The third step would be considering whether or not the patient needs medication. And certainly if the patient has at least moderate or worse ADHD, and most people do, then medication becomes instrumental in helping to manage them, because by and large, the medications are the most effective things we have for managing ADHD. And I'm a psychologist, and yet I'm telling you the literature is overwhelming in reaching that conclusion. So probably 70% to 80% of patients at some point in our treatment of them will need medication of some type. And then we get into the modification. Modification means changing the behavior of others, like parents and teachers, in order to change the behavior of the child or the patient. So it's behavior modification. So this means by altering the way we manage the person, we can alter the way they respond to us and perhaps help them to be more effective. This is where you would see things like daily behavior report cards going to school. You would see things like parents adjusting the way they use praise and recognition and approval, and even rewards and punishments at home. So parents alter their behavior in order to alter the child's behavior. And that's very helpful as well. It's not as helpful as medication, and often it works better if the person is on medication. But it's another treatment approach, and that is modifying our behavior to modify the patient's behavior. And then the last one is accommodations. Now, accommodations refer to altering the physical environment. And by doing that, you then create a better opportunity for the person to succeed. So this would be something like reorganizing the homework place where your child does homework. Like if they do work in their room, reorganizing that so it's more conducive to getting homework done. It might be having the child sit up front in the classroom so that a teacher can interact, supervise, and provide consequences more often to that patient. Might be something like breaking the curriculum down into much smaller units so that when a child has an assignment to do, they don't have to do 30 at a time. They do 5, take a few minute break, then do 5 more, then take another break. And that's a physical adjustment to the environment that helps the patient succeed. So those would be the 5 things we would do: evaluation, education, medication, modification, and accommodation. And those 5 become very important. Now, how does the executive model of ADHD fit in here? Well, it tells us some very important things. First of all, we know that it's a neurobiological condition, and as a result, that might justify us looking at medications that are known to alter these neurobiological processes that are going wrong in the brain. And that's exactly what the ADHD medications do. Unfortunately, they only do it during the time you take the medication. So very much like insulin for diabetes, you take your medication, it helps you that day. But as soon as you stop it, you're back to being a diabetic. And in this case, you're back to being ADHD again. But nevertheless, you can temporarily alter these underlying neurobiological problems in order to improve the condition to some degree. And in over half of the children and adults, it actually helps to normalize their behavior. But another 30% are not normalized even if they're improved, and they're going to need additional assistance. So the executive view is a neurobiological view, and it justifies the use of neurobiological interventions. Now, also, the executive view tells us that things you're trying to do to yourself aren't working very well. You're trying to use images, you're trying to use self-speech to manage your own behavior, and you're trying to use your mind's eye, so to speak, to be aware of yourself, and they're not succeeding very well. So are there things that we could do around you to help boost those abilities? And the answer is yes, by, for instance, having you put things around you, little reminders, charts, signs, lists, symbols, cues, anything you can think of, sticky notes, cards, that helps that child to remember what they're supposed to remember about how to behave at that particular point. So a teacher might put a card on a desk about the rules for reading lab or math lab or science time. A parent might have cards at home that deal with chores the child has to do, like cleaning your room, and on the card would be a list of some very specific steps about what it means to clean your room. So these kinds of things, these cues, can be used in critical places in the environment to help you show what you know, and that is to help boost your weak executive system. And the same is true with helping you with emotional control. Are there things we could teach you that you could employ when you're emotional to help calm down? And that might involve things like cognitive behavior therapy. I'm sure you're very familiar with that, teaching the individual to stop and think about their emotions, to identify them, maybe teaching them deep breathing, muscle relaxation exercises. More recently, people have had some success at mindfulness meditation training with children and adults with ADHD. All of this would come in handy in helping to slow down your emotions and help you try to get more control over them. We can help to boost your motivational problems by adding external motivation around you. So you might not be so motivated to get the praise or approval of your teacher, but if the teacher were to reward you with tokens or points or extra privileges or some such system, you might find that those external rewards would help to boost the weak internal motivational system that the individual is having trouble with. So there are ways of manipulating the environment around you that might be useful for addressing these executive problems, but we wouldn't have thought of doing that if we didn't view ADHD as this weak executive system. And finally, the problem-solving weakness that I mentioned as one of the executive problems might be boosted by having the individual solve problems manually rather than try to do it all mentally. For instance, would it be better to use a number line and a Backus, some marbles, to help do math problems rather than try to do them all in your head? Would it be useful to have the person jot their thoughts down on different 3x5 file cards and then organize the file cards into a storyline rather than try to do it all in your head? These are the kinds of external accommodations that come to mind when you're dealing with somebody who has an executive problem. I mean, I could go on endlessly. As you know, I've written books on this subject. But the long and the short of it is the executive view would show you to look in these areas and give you some ideas about how to boost the weak executive system, whereas just viewing ADHD as attention disorder wouldn't have taught you that.
I like that. And I like that sort of the dream interventions or the dream treatment plan, if you will, just isn't saying, you know, mom's the problem, the teacher's the problem, but also doesn't say, well, hey, 1 week of or 1 hour of therapy a week is going to solve this, you know, but what can we do at home? What can we do in school to sort of to make accommodations, those kinds of things?
Yes. Yeah. Well, and the most common approach we take to parents right out of the gate is we use diabetes as an analogy. ADHD is the diabetes of psychiatry. And so nobody approaches diabetes as, what can I do in a week to cure this, and then we don't have to worry about it. We know that diabetes is a chronic condition. We know it has to be managed every day. But we also know by doing so, you can lead a relatively normal life, and we can prevent all of those secondary harms that develop when your diabetes isn't managed, like heart disease and blindness and infection and even amputation. Those are things that happen if you don't manage your diabetes very well. And ADHD is very much like that. And if you can move parents and even adults with ADHD over to kind of the diabetic analogy of ADHD, they really come to understand it better, and they don't shop for these kinds of magic cures that you were talking about or these short-term treatments. They understand that this is chronic, and it has to be managed chronically.
All right. Well, before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to add or anything else you think people should know? I mean, obviously...
Well, I would like parents and the general public to keep in mind what I said earlier, but I think it's a very important point because the media these days, the trade media and other sources, portray ADHD as a myth. It isn't. There's more than 10,000 scientific papers published on ADHD. The second is they portray it as a socially caused condition due to bad parents, failing schools, too much TV and video game playing, and other nonsense like that. And it isn't. ADHD is the most biologically, the most genetically influenced of the psychiatric disorders. And among those biological disorders, it ranks right up there with bipolar disorder and autism in terms of the extent to which It's a neurobiological condition. So that leads to several things people need to take home with them. Parents, you didn't cause this. On the other hand, you're on the hook for doing something about it. If your child had diabetes, you know you didn't cause it, but you're on the hook for doing something to manage that. And ADHD is exactly like that. Parents have to take responsibility for managing somebody with a chronic disorder. The other thing that it suggests is that where necessary, where appropriate, neurobiological solutions can be helpful. In this case, we're talking about things like medication. Just as we use insulin for diabetics, we can use ADHD medications to help. They're not the answer, they're not the be-all, they're not the only treatment, but they're a very important part of that treatment program. Finally, it tells people to move away from the moralizing, the moral judgment of ADHD behavior, as if this person could just wake up tomorrow morning, change their behavior, smell the coffee, and get on with life. This isn't something that the person is choosing to do. It's not a lifestyle choice, and it's not just bad behavior that a child is doing to get attention. This really is part of the individual's neurobiology. So give up the moralizing and move to a more science-based view of the disorder, and you'll find you have less guilt, you'll induce less guilt in your child, and you'll have a much happier relationship with the individual.
Great. Well, people can hear more from you at your website's ADHDlectures.com and check out your books at russellbarkley.org. And thanks again for talking to us.
Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Visit the podcast at www.mentalhealthday.org.
Malfunction. Thank you.